Hello and welcome back to our podcast about a fanfic of a fanfic that itself is a synthesis of Fallout, the popular game about a post-apocalyptic wasteland, and My Little Pony, a popular show about pastel horses. I'm Fi, joined again with my co-host, Weird. I didn't fuck up most of it this time. Say hello, Weird.
No, however, I, Sir Weirdington Esquire, shall give my greetings to our beloved listeners. Hello, dear listeners. Hello.
Yes, hello, back again. We made it. We're still alive. I'm going to keep saying that every time. It's probably not that funny, but boy, does it feel like we're dead a little bit more every time we do this podcast. So
Yes, it is. This is a corrosive endeavor. We are doing a wrong thing. I think we may be the bad guys.
We were the enclave guys the whole time.
Speaking of the baddies, to do our recap, I actually can't recall one of the two chapters that we did last week. For the life of me, so the previous week we faced off against Gorgon, who's indestructible and super strong, and turned people with stone in his eyes, and he can fly. And then something, Blackjack wakes up with him, with not knowing how she got where she is now, under the care of a priest. And we meet the most precocious little ragamuffin who holds essential supplies for surviving in the hostile wastes for ransom, a deeply unreasonable ransom, extorting people for essential supplies. And she's just such a cute little ragamuffin about it. And surely the waste will be a better place when she's an adult and is able to inflict this mass scale. So Blackjack, after receiving some cryptic things that relate to the previous story about this priestly guy asking about Blackjack's preferred virtues,
yes,
which apparently relates subtly back to the original show and how the six original ponies each had a element of friendship
that they espoused and were considered like an enshrined element of harmony and friendship.
None of which are considered at all valuable in this setting.
Nope, not at all.
Laughter, loyalty, generosity, all garbage.
Well, there is a theme in this story and the original story of corrupted virtues, which it's more relevant in the original story than it is in this one. But the idea is that they are, a lot of the characters reflect poisoned or corrupted versions of the original elements of harmony in one way or another. But that's a story for another time, because it's not really necessarily related to our piece, our work right now in Project Horizons.
Anyway, so yeah, she gets drunk and wanders into the heart of Footsburg, which is known to be an unsurvivable, filled with automated weapons deathscape. Wanders into a museum because, drunk, and why not? Wherein we get a little bit of exposition about the setting, and we're introduced to this character, Goldenmane.
It's important to note, it is not a little exposition. I cut a lot of it for time. There is a lot of exposition in the museum.
So we drown in a brief sea of exposition. Right, a chapter long
sea of words.
Yeah, we're waterboarded by shit.
Waterboarded with
very
words.
Little cause to remember. Save one, which is the incredibly fascistic speech of the founder of Footsburg, Goldenmane, wherein apparently a thematic phrase of the series, "The Hoof Rises," is put in, and that is why this is called Hoofington, as the hoof rises, which in human terms is the foot rises,
or the hand rises,
to stomp down on something.
Yes. It is very much imagine like a hoof stamping on humanity forever. Like it's that.
You want to see the future of ponykind? Imagine a hoof stomping on a pony face forever.
That's where we are right now in terms of tone.
So the shocking reveal that we were wrong. It is not Footbug, but indeed Goose Stepsville.
Goose Stepsville. The town of fascism.
Oh, the town fascism.
Fascism. Fascism of the future.
It's town fascism built because like apparently like so something we've been skipping over is that apparently a lot of people throughout Goose Stepsville are prone to quoting the foot rises, but in sarcasm because like the foot rising is like resulted in the crushed stomped on result that you see before you. Coming across that, we have another obligatory fight scene that Fi assures us, oh, this one is actually competently written. This is like a fun, like Blackjack gets some quippy one-liners, bring a tear to Dwayne the Rock Johnson's eye. and so, like, she drunkenly slaughters a bunch of people and finds the katana. The most magnificent of all swords. It can cut through a tin can like butter.
10,000 times folded over Napanai steel. That's where we are right now. We are shitty like market fair folded carbon steel katana.
Imbued with destructive magic that our trench coated drunk loner hero can now bisect people with. And the last thing I recall is she takes her new 10 times folded Nepalese steel out further and into the wilderness of the core of Gustavsville.
Oh no, it's much more confusing than that. She doesn't have that, and instead she has a dragon claw as a weapon, which I can't figure out where she got that from in the story. Like I must have just glazed over as a detail. But no, she doesn't have the katana. She has a dragon claw, which is pretty much just as good for a while in the story.
Okay, so we're just introduced to the katana. Like the katana is framed as a thing that exists and is there for the grabbing.
We're given to salivate over it. Yes, it's the locked box, you know, lockpick 100 like item that you have to come back for because you need the key like three, four more missions into the story.
I guess it's, what, sealed in indestructible fiberglass or something? Like,
I guess.
Why wouldn't like a fucking raging drunk see this like rad, like, rad Ginzu knife and not just like, oh, that's a cool thing. Good thing it's mine now.
I love how BJ is turning slowly into like a redneck weeaboo.
we've already like described her lady, but her colossal lady boner, her like literal fascistic love, fetishistic lust for firearms. So we weren't that far off. She's a small town cop, like in the first place,
yeah.
Who nobody in town liked. They're not even the other cops, like. This is over, like, and her emotional landscape is that of a school shooter, as we've talked about before. She is that cop that, like, murders whoever she, like, feels like she can get away with in town. Like,
yep. Oh, yeah, we'll get into more of that during these next two chapters, which we should probably launch into. So that's pretty much all that happened these last two chapters, by the way, folks.
We end off on, like, the incredibly nihilistic view of a bunch of, like, ponies who have, like, lost sight of hope because of the, like, endless, like, cruelty and despair of the waste and the total, like, atomization of everyone's moral philosophy in the face of the disaster just lining up to be disintegrated by an automatic guarding the heart of the city. So that's where we ended off. And so, what quirks did we pick?
Yeah, on that entirely nihilistic tone, what video game tropes did we get? So let me just go through my notes. So in chapter 10, I don't understand how she gained this power, but she got the perk of telebullets or telekinetic bullets. Her telekinesis is now refined enough that she can, like, fashion it essentially into a bullet that she can psychically murder people with.
She is now never unarmed. She has adopted the gun into her heart. Her very essence is reshaped into her life's love. She is the gun.
She is a gun. Oh no! Oh, that's the whole theme of this story, isn't it? Oh, holy shit! Oh, I never thought about that. This whole story is about BJ turning into a gun.
And now, her inner heart reflects that. It's all that is left is for the rest of her body to follow suit.
Oh, man. Oh, Christ.
She now has the heart of a gun. Next, she needs to fully attain the mind of a gun. She still feels sad watching these depressives walk into an automated turret. No, she is not fully gun yet.
She must become gun. Oh, man. Oh, that's a revelation that I just had.
All right, so we did two chapters. One, heart bullets. Her very soul is now a gun. And what else did she gain?
She gains another point of tough hide as a perk, which we established before. Right. She got from being Zenkai shot boost. The first time.
Yeah,
she's been Zenkai boost. Oh, she's a Super Saiyan. Oh, man.
You're not average pony anymore, Kakarot.
I've realized the legend. I've become a super pony. Oh, man. Well, I guess after that fun, we get to launch in this incredibly depressing chapter. Massive content warning for it's either this chapter or the next one after this for this episode. I had a read over it, and I was, like, deeply troubled by this, and I'm kind of worried about the rest of the vector on which our story proceeds after this, but let's launch right in. So chapter 12, denial. We open back up with Priest and BJ having a conversation where BJ insists that he could have done something to save them, and then he just, you know, sort of calmly reminds her that he's a pacifist and also would not force people to like against their will. Like, they were clearly dead set and wanted to kill themselves, so, like, he can't actually do anything to solve that problem. They have a bit of a back and forth between this, and it's also where we revealed how the Crusaders got formed, was that a lot of these people would go to get euthanized by the bridge. Priest would insist the children stay behind, and that faction got formed out of the, like, orphans of the Mercy. You right there, weird?
Religiously radicalized suicide children. That's why they're fucking... I don't know why it didn't occur to me that, like, these, like, this militaristic group of children constituted child soldiers.
Yep.
But it recruited a world of such pure desperation. Oh, they wanted to die. But now they've recommitted their lives to the Lord.
They recommitted their lives both to survival and God, because this place is also a church. Don't forget that part.
Oh, I wonder if they, like, cut off people's noses and ears. that's how, okay. Anyway.
We end the scene off with kind of like a, I don't know. I think it's kind of evocative, but it's still kind of dumb. Where Priest is giving a sermon that BJ gets, like, the last bits of. And they have this big giant church music scene where everyone's playing music using magical instruments. Because I mentioned before that the Crusaders they're helping were all musically themed. This is where that comes back up, that they're using their special talents to make music, and they're all do this big giant church music thing. It's kind of neat and evocative, but it still has the problem of being juxtaposed via, like, next to suicide and radicalized Crusader horses.
Crusader baby horses. It's very Crusader important. Crusading child soldiers.
Crusade babies. How our dreams come true.
Don't fault.
Is that the worst image you've ever had in your head? Probably.
Death to the blasphemer.
Death. I am a mayor of God. Yeah. So we scene cut. I started marking these down because some of these are pretty like severe. BJ's just sort of wandering around the area to clear her head of all of the murder. When she gets back into town, she finds out that Sakashi, my favorite character, is in the post office regaling the Crusaders with various stories, which is kind of interesting. Like she tells the story like interesting mythological stories about like how zebras got their stripes and how ponies are all different pastel colors, and it's kind of just it's not even world building. It's just kind of like a interesting character flair. Like I always talk about how much I like Sakashi and her storytelling stuff. It's just cool, whatever. But she meets back up with her because she's trying to figure out what the hell happened to her friends, obviously, because they're gone. Sakashi informs BJ and subsequently us. They were on a rail car that I don't know how it's powered because there's no coal in the setting anymore, but...
Human blood.
They probably.
And that's not a misspeak. Like, they're like, presumably there are humans in this setting that are mine as a racehorse. That's the headcanon. That's what we're going with.
There's humans here, and they're being used for fuel. It depends if Project Human's canon or not.
God damn it, no. I take it back. No. Pony bones. That's it. They're burning.
There's no... I told you, there's no bottom. We're excavating into the earth. But yeah, they get stopped on the way because a brown unicorn, as Sakashi describes, because it's all from her perspective, obviously, so she doesn't know who this person is. It's U21. He stops the party and gets into an argument with 21, who basically calls him out for, you know, helping being Blackjack there.
Continuing to be a Quisling? Oh, the other way around. Is it?
Yeah, 21's calling out. Is calling out 21 for working with Blackjack and he makes allusions to like, oh, is she your master? Like, does she own you? Are you still her fuck toy? Like, which gets them all riled up, and 21 still insists to like not join with him or whatever they're doing. So they get jumped instead by Deus's guys. Oh shit, I forgot. While this is all happening, Blackjack is unconscious because of that trapped memory orb that I talked about in the last chapter. So her and Sakashi and her daughter, but it doesn't matter, are on the rail system while 21 and Morning Glory are getting jumped. And while that's happening, Sakashi makes the decision to try and bail and with the rail car, which like splits and like. BJ fell off at some point on the rails, and that's how she ended up in chapel. Oh boy. They have a minor conversation because zebras are convinced that Goose Stepsville is cursed, which it is, and she talks about it, and there's kind of an awkward moment of like, you know, of kind of mild zebra racism. And Sakashi had like sort of discusses about it, which is then switches over to talking about BJ's sex drive for some fucked up reason. Sex comes up a lot in this story, and like I don't know how to talk about it in this context because it's a critical theme, but it's also kind of weird to talk about horse sex. Like Sakashi makes allusions to, oh, it's like, oh, are you interested in 21, and kind of like nudges him, and she, this is when BJ reveals her misandry, which is fun. She's like, oh well, it's hard because like in the stable, I would just sign up to his his breeding rotation, and like I wouldn't have to worry about it. And Sakashi's like, "Huh, that's kind of weird. Are the males like allowed to say no?" And BJ's like, "Why would they? Men just live for sex. What are you talking about?" And Sakashi's like, for a really long time. And she's like, all right, next time you see 21, why don't you ask him about his feelings about the stable and why he's so mad all the time, and maybe he'll answer you about that. Just food for thought. Continue to prove to Sakashi to be the only sensible one in this story so far.
You incurious bitch.
But yeah.
I mean, I appreciate Sakashi's patience. Maybe her patience would winnow if she knew. Like, if she had, like an awful lot of interaction with B-21.
Yeah, she only knows what she knows about them from a very small interaction. So, like, she doesn't know that 21's also a piece of shit. But, anyways, BJ decides to depart alone because Sakashi isn't a fighter, which is also false, which I think Somber forgot about this. In later scenes, Sakashi is a badass martial artist with a bow staff, and at this point, she's just like, oh no, I'm a storyteller, I don't want to fight. And I think later on, it's just a cop-out that she's like a pacifist or something. But anyways, BJ decides to depart for the rail line to reunite with her friends. We get more of DJ Human on the radio, talking up how BJ just stopped that slaver camp. BJ then literally falls into a pile of corpses that are freshly killed, where she notices that they're really, really conveniently murdered, like literally minutes before she got here, and they happen to have a whole bunch of like supplies on them that she needs, and like she like notices a figure out in the darkness and sees some sort of mysterious benefactor is what she assumes. Sure is convenient you murdered all these people.
No, just like that's one hell of like a fairy godmother. Like I'm just imagining the like sort of like Brock Samson but like worse kind of psychopath of like that person has this sort of thing that Black Cat hates. Into the hole.
Into the hole.
Like the kind of like fever dream logic of like you, I mean, if you're gonna kill people for their stuff or just mug them, like, you don't need to incorporate the body, like, with the things that you're trying to pass on to this person.
Yeah. So to spoil a little, this benefactor is, in fact, a Brock Samson-style, like, psychopath. Like, so you are right, like, you're dead on.
I am helping.
But anyways, BJ comes across the like overturned flatbed of the rail car that she was caught on. She sees some people there and she assumes they're probably bounty hunters because there's some enemy like tags on her pip buck as well. But she decides to make the choice of at least giving them a chance, which allows her to walk into this incredibly crazy elaborate trap that is actually kind of a fun addition into the story. So she gets sprung in a trap where the flatbed's full of horses that have like rad roaches on them to make like the enemy signals come off, and then like lights come on and this booming voice announces that they're like the member they declare themselves Virgo Zodiac, a member of the Zodiac family, some family of legendary bounty hunters. And she has trapped Blackjack in an elaborate trap that she can't possibly escape. And my favorite thing about it is that, like, BJ, like, just lets her talk because she's incredibly narcissistic while she starts, like, undoing the hostages, which is kind of a fun...
Yeah, that's it. It's a cute, like, it's a cute sort of, like, Saturday morning cartoon kind of joke. Like,
And she explains, like, oh, the trap is elaborate, like, all the robots are trained to kill anything that move, and all of the mines around you are so close together that if you try to turn off one, turn off all the other, and the area you're in is filled with a deadly neurotoxin in this box that if you try to step out of it will release and knock you unconscious. And like BJ's like, huh, all right. So she shoots at one of the robots, which all their motion just like triggers each other and they all just murder each other. And she just picks up the box with telekinesis and throws it into the mines. Like, I kind of love it in the just the like, oh, how am I going to get out of this? What if I just broke it? Like, it's one of those examples that, like, I Somber kind of waltzes into accidentally. Of, like, Somber is like, BJ is kind of that, like, concept of, like, dumb, not savant, because that's not really the word for it, but, like, she's very practically minded, but, like, the author just counts that as stupid, which is frustrating because it allows you to excuse a ton of behavior on BJ just being dumb with air quotes.
I mean, it sounds like the sort of Captain Kirk or the like.
She's pretty much Captain Kirk. When she's penned well, I guess, like when she isn't a nightmare. Anyways, it's revealed that Virgo is kind of just like a small, not a child, basically just young and kind of like kind of an idiot. And she takes pity on her for the trap and all that shit. And sadly, the explosion of the mines going off does cause one casualty. The shades get destroyed in the blast.
No! Dragon shades!
I know, I was so disappointed. Like, I looked at this and I'm like, oh, Weird's gonna be heartbroken.
No! Like, first gun, now you shades!
At two sunglasses.
All we've got to look forward to is that dumbass katana. All my favorite characters.
All your favorite characters are inanimate. As you are a jukebox. It's love of a kind.
Check out our YouTube channel.
Yeah, we don't have time to mourn the sunglasses. I honestly think it was one of those cases of like Sombra really not like not being happy with like the aesthetics of his character and constantly wanting to change them all the time. It's like, okay, it'd be cool if she had sunglasses. Sunglasses are kind of lame, so get rid of them. Oh, it'd be really cool if she had this thing. Well, those are kind of lame. She should get a different kind of uniform. That's not really that interesting. She gets a different thing. There's a lot of that. Like, it seems very inconsistent. Like, it feels very...
This thing is being written and immediately published by the chapter, so...
Regardless, the hostages she saved pointed in the right direction of the Enclave to find Glory, because like it's apparently like Glory got picked up by the Enclave while the fight was happening with 21, so she's now tracking down Morning Glory. Yay! Okay, now we're getting to another scene transition, and I'm kind of worried about talking about this. So this is where we get into some content warning shit, and I open this point with, do I talk about pony masturbation?
This entire project is so cursed! Talking about pony masturbation. Fie, you idiot. You ignorant slut. Of course you do. Of course you do.
Okay, so...
It can't be avoided. That'd be too much intrigue. If you left the questions like that unanswered, people might actually wind up reading this trash. It's your job. No!
I'm sorry. You're so right. Okay.
You have to talk about pony. There are two choices. Either completely leave it on the table, and in which case, what are we even doing here? Like, what is the point of, like, any of this we've survived so far? You're just going to leave it on the table and leave it completely unmentioned. Or go all in! You can't tease your audience with pony masturbation and just leave it at that, walk away.
Okay, so this we get into the scene break.
Does she do it with the hilt of one of her guns?
No, it's much worse than that. That's why I'm worried.
Oh, the barrel!
No, it's not. The pony masturbation isn't the part that's worrying. Okay, so
it's gold mine, and you're like, am I gonna mine the gold in them? That are heels? Yes, no. Right. On one hand, cold. On the other hand, hard.
All right, we need to turn you down one step from Alex Jones. We open up this scene with BJ taking camp for the night, and I don't understand why Sombra put this in. Well, no, I know why. It's to one up the main story. But there's a bit where BJ's like, well, I can't rest, so I guess I'll just fuck myself.
Relatable. We've all been...
Big mood.
Yeah, I'm tired. I guess I'll just fuck myself. All right.
BJ yeah. is a big mood, but she's like, okay, well, maybe I can use some of the stolen information she has for stimulus. Oh God, I can't believe this is how this goes.
What?
So she comes across the fact that P-21's files are on her pip butt because they were on duct tapes. It turns out that P-21 has been keeping audio diaries of everyone he's ever fucked, which includes literally every major character we've explained so far in Stable 99. Because, of course, 21, not only the stud who's always right, the stud who fucks the best in the whole story. Because, of course, he's a virile male.
Highly in demand.
Yes. But where we get real bad, I specifically put the lines... BJ spank material quickly goes south.
Secret name of this chapter.
It's going to be in the show notes. She finds that she has... Okay, we need to get through this. Like, we're giggly right now, but this is actually pretty fucked up and dire. She finds out that there's 3 entries of herself on 21's file list. I also have to talk about that. BJ also brings up the notion that all mares in Stable 99 have sterility implants that they're given to at a young age so that they can't overpopulate the stable. I would not bring this up if it was not critical to the story. Her sterility and lack thereof in later parts of the story are actually incredibly important to later chapters.
Oh, God.
But... we are getting there, and I'm shaking, I'm so upset about what I'm about to talk about. We get a recording of Blackjack, who is at the Overmare's party, where we find out that BJ as a kid was fucking evil, and her and Daisy, who was her best friend when they were kids, are, like, not kids, I guess they were, like, young teenagers, whatever, it's fucked up, it's fucked up to think about it at all, what age these kids actually are, where they're arguing about what of the two males they want to, like, want, and Daisy gets the better one in BJ's young recording version of it, and she gets the crying one, which is P1, which was P21. So we find out that P1 means that he's just enough, like, above age to be, like, capable of being a breeder, I guess, is what that technically means. And BJ was his first rapist, essentially. Like this genuinely makes me fucking uncomfortable that, like, the author included this. Like I forgot about this scene entirely, and I forgot that this is what happened. And, like, the worst problem with this is that Somber is incredibly soft on rapists in general in these stories. Like, they're often forgiven with very little, like, worth of forgiveness. And I trace it back to the scene because I think Somber needs you to be okay with the fact that BJ forced herself on 21, and that's the kernel of why he hates her. It's not the only reason why he hates her, but, like, it's the first justification given. It is so incredibly fucked up that it's in this story, and, like, I don't even really know what to say about it. Like, I don't know. What are your thoughts on it, Weird?
I mean...
I'm kind of...
My thoughts are complicated. From the point of view of, like, story making, like, it's a heck of a twist. Kind of well set up, I guess, from the, like, magical black lady, proposing, hey, maybe you should, like, investigate, like... why this other person might feel resentful toward you. Is she horrified that, what is Blackjack's emotional response to this information?
She's pretty shocked up and horrified. Like, she is confused and fucked up about it because, like, she doesn't have the language to understand why she did something wrong, but, like, knows that, like, what she's experienced in the waste makes her feel wrong about it. Like I'm not going to sugarcoat or try to pretend that, like, BJ is okay in doing this in the story, but, like, there is at least setup that she's, like, just lacks the, like, clarity from being in a, like, basically a rape factory stable for her entire life to even be able to, like, articulate why it's bad in the first place, which is understandable, but, like, to ratchet back out, like, this is not a real person. This is a story about a person. And Somber chose to include this, yeah. And that isn't okay.
No, the thing that's particularly bad is, like, is presenting... So, yeah, no, so, like, this comes into, like, this would be a very difficult thing to, like, explain to a fan of this product, because I yes. predict, like, I could make $100 betting that the first thing they would do is make a Thermion argument. And to those who are not familiar, there's a media critic named Dan Olson who has presented the concept of a Thermion argument, which is excusing really distasteful things in a story by arguing the story as though it is a documentary, like a true relation of fact. When Somber is the one who set up this, like, fucking drow horse, like, matriarchal, like, man rape society, nothing about the rest of the story as presented would lead me to believe that this is well handled. Like, I can maybe map out in my head a hypothetical case where, like, a story like this could like be a insightful meditation on people as a product of their societies. That a lot of, like, grotesque things happen in a culture because it's normalized and growing beyond your own societal expectations. Like, they're like, along those lines, and interestingly, there is an important question of, like, how it was that P21 himself was radicalized into thinking this isn't a normal, acceptable burden that, like, is just his. Like, who the fuck was talking to him? Like, where was the, like, where was the, like, seditious, like, pamphlet that he read?
Yeah,
like,
that incited his initial hatred.
Yeah,
so we get bits of it that he had, like, a lover who, oh boy, I guess I'm spoiling later things.
No,
for part.
No, don't. No, we'll leave it on. It's an enticing mystery. We've got to leave something for people to.
There is a person who incises whatever in like gets 21 on the thinking track of hating the system. So there's at least some sense in that. But yeah, oh man,
this is an incredibly, like, delicate topic that the author who brought us such gems as The Gun and Goose Steps Bird broadly, like, I don't trust to, like, be able to, like, handle tactfully. Like,
it's an incredibly dire topic that really shouldn't be handled by someone who is just so vapid in their storytelling. In a lot of cases, like, it's wild to think about that there is an arc to this. Like, it isn't just like, oh yeah, BJ was a rapist, but she's fine now. There is an arc of redemption to her, but, like, we're gonna get to it, and we're gonna make a decision. Like, we're gonna have to make a judgment call on whether or not we feel as an audience that she's justified in this, because Somber doesn't necessarily make a great case for her being redeemed by it. Because again, this story in general is incredibly soft on rapists. And on top of that, rape victims lose a lot of their autonomy to talk about the problem of it as well. To not spoil some of people's motivations. A lot of characters who are victims of this stuff lose a lot of their ability to be victims in this story. It's kind of fucked up. God, I'm so sorry for this project, everyone. Like, this is part of the reason why I want to talk about this, because, like, people who hate the story hate this for such surface levels. Like, they hate it because they don't like that it went Evangelion, that is the common, like, mockery of it. They don't like that the main villain came out of nowhere. They don't like things that happened to Blackjack.
Wow. leaving, like, this on the table. Leaving, yeah. Like...
Yeah, but yeah, this is fine to them. Like, this community is fine with rape, but they don't like it when a space ninja kamikazes into the moon. Like
I for one welcome the space ninja.
that sounds like a welcome breeze from the fucked up shit we just read. Anyways, I guess we should move on to the rest of chapter 12 and then moving into chapter 13. So BJ gets to the air station that she's been the Enclave are holed up on the tarmac. She fights a
hold on. Okay, wait. The spank bank she accesses, the first thing that occurs to her is to tap into the secret diary of her like enslaved gigolo friend who like presents her.
And then the scene just kind of ends.
Okay, so where is she? The tarmac of what?
Yeah, it's a scene that only exists to like for us to learn that fact, and Sombra didn't have a good way of that organically being in the story, so it said pony masturbation, which again is just to one up the main story because that also happened in the original story, because you know this whole story is an inferiority complex told in 78 pages, like chapters.
In the original story, someone uncovers dark secrets inside of a spank bank.
No, specifically the pony masturbation. That was the part that
okay.
Pony masturbation was the thing that got had to be in this story too because it was in the original.
Okay. staring down a tunnel.
Starting to stare down a tunnel. It's dark. It's dark and dire. All right. Shall I press on then? Before we get too stuck on this detail.
So she arrives at the tarmac of a what now?
Of an air station, which is just an airport. She gets flagged down by an Enclave pony in armor, who she tries to parlay with, and the Claver just ignores her, and then she has to shoot him because of that, and then steals his gear. We're going to be jetting through this part real fast.
I can't let you, just like, hey, don't ignore me, you son of a bitch. Is that what happened? Am I mistaken?
She's basically like, hey, how's it going? They shot at her, and it's like, all right, I guess you're dead now.
All right, that's a little better. I misheard you and thought you said that she tried to hail them down. They ignored her, so she murdered them and took their stuff.
Anyways, we got to zip through this. She just wanders around the building looking for the rest of the Enclave that's there. She bumps into the lockers of Macintosh's Marauders.
God damn it! Macintosh gets the fuck around.
Yes, he does. But this is where we learn the full list of names, which I considered omitting, but I realized that every single one of these names are important. So we get Jetstream, Vanity, Twist, Doof, Echo, Psalm, and a name in A, which is a zebra name, but I don't remember what it is, and it's important 70 chapters later. And Stonewing, which was Gorgon, the one who could fly and was made of invincible stone.
And Dum Dum Dugan, and Nick Fury, and the rest.
Well, I realized that, Macintosh is Sergeant Rock. That's what the reference is supposed to be. Like Sergeant Rock, and is I don't remember what the name of his commandos were, but they're all weirdly high tech, and they need an inputted password. And she tries Stonewings and remembers back into the memory orb that Stonewing was sweet on Rainbow Dash. So she tries that as a password, and it just finds a bunch of pictures that are just more backstory stuff. It's just, hey, these were a found family of military horses. We get it. She runs into a couple more Enclaves who were eating in the cafeteria and decides not to kill them this time. Instead, duct tapes them together. Because BJ is incredibly childish and Sombra needs to remind you of that. She wanders around and ends up in the air traffic control tower, which she has a moment of actually like cool vertigo because it turns out that BJ is afraid of heights, which makes sense given that she's living in the ground her entire life, and trips over a memory orb that she gets that ends up activating when she uses
things are just all over the fucking ground. Remember, I was as common as trees in the after skate.
Yeah, they're just boxes of memory orbs everywhere.
Not even, they're loose. I guess the box is decayed with weathering in time, and so you can't walk a mile without stumbling over somebody's stolen recollections.
Everywhere is just the world's deadliest ball pit. Christ. But anyways, we get the familiar ooze, which you guys don't know about because you don't read these things, and good on ya. But we get the Memory Orb. It's another one of Memory Orbs of a Minerva McIntosh Marauder. It's about Jetstream, who is distraught over Stonewing's death, which obviously wasn't really dead because he shows up in this later in this. But she's distraught because she was in love with him, and she's confiding in the grief counselor, who is also one of her friends named Vanity. And this is only really important that we learn that Vanity has the power to remove memories, which is actually like an interesting use of memory orbs, because usually they're just audio diaries. And the idea that someone was like so distraught over someone and they couldn't deal with it that they were using the memory orbs to actually like excise their memories of their like feelings for a person.
Eternal spot shine of the exposition MacGuffin.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to be positive. But yeah, BJ wakes up in an interrogation room several hours later to find out that Morning Glory had put it there because she knew that... I guess she knew that BJ was going to end up there somehow.
I see you stumbled over our exposition trap.
It's a double exposition trap. It's layers within layers.
You know what would be great? Actually, like, if somebody did that intentionally, like set up sort of landmines of memory orbs, and each one of them is the guy who came up with the idea, like taking a memory of him waiting around in a room for like 5 hours, like doing a puzzle or playing Parcheesi, and at the end of the recorded memory, he looks up at the viewer and goes, "Got fucked, huh?"
Gotcha. All right, that's our cue to swing right into chapter 13. But before that, you should all go to the lobby, get yourself some snacks, some drinks, get some exercise, pause the recording if you have to, take a nap, drink some water,
drugs.
Eat food.
I don't do it myself, yeah, but I understand that like some of you like
if you have medication that you should be taking, remember to take it.
Take
some time for yourself.
Valid drugs as well, but yeah. Also recreational. Yeah. Like if you happen to have it, if you have the sort of taste for psychedelic alteration, maybe that will help you through what's coming.
I've been enjoying that this podcast is so miserable. We've had to invent a self care like corner segment. Just so I can
get a
deal
pillow.
With the crap.
Do you have plushes in your house? Snuggle. Like and like acquire snuggle. Acquire snuggle buddy. Share snacks between you. And come right back to us.
Yes. So yeah, welcome back from your break to chapter 13, Turnabout. Okay, we get a cool big brief description of the operations area that the Enclave has turned into their little home base. It's very clean and well maintained as opposed to everything else they've seen so far. Turns out this particular faction of the Enclave is controlled by a character named Operative Lighthooves, who I put a note in here, but a spoiler, because I forgot what his fucking relation to the story is, and it made me lose my mind for 10 minutes. Operative Lighthooves is actually like kind of a fun villain because he's like unflappably nice, and that's like the sinister part of him. Like he is clinically nice, essentially. Like he's like, oh, you know, you killed some of my Enclave members. Like, oh, you're very efficient. You like a job? You seem really good with a gun. Like he's just like he can't be fazed by the things that are happening. Despite BJ's efforts, we also find out that the other important members are a sergeant named Wind Whisper and a unicorn named Minty Fresh, because it turns out that the Enclave, despite being pony racist, tolerate unicorns because they're useful. They don't frame it like this, but that's the way it's framed. There are unicorns that have spells that allow them to walk on clouds, and they need them because they are the only ones that can make the magic technology that makes the Enclave run, so they're useful idiots, basically. To the Fash. Turns out Glory was KIA because of her organization going tits up. I'm just doing checkpoints at this point. They mention one of the settlements in the sky, Thunderhead, a few times as being a really important place. We get a lot of stuff about the Raider disease and how the Enclave is apparently trying to deal with it and figure out how to solve the problem. Because of Glory's like information and notes on it. In fact, they're so gung-ho about trying to stop the Raider thing that they need to get some more test subjects. So they're going to fly BJ out with some of the Enclave to wipe out some Raiders and get their heads and bring them back for test subjects. They fly there in a Vertibuck in our next scene, which a Vertibuck, if for those playing at home, is in story, a flying cloud vehicle that is has to be pulled by Pegasi, therefore it doesn't disgrace the Pegasi way of flight. But in our own universe, we prefer to believe that they're deer with helicopter antler rudders that they fly around on.
Yes. True facts.
They have some. We learned about the fact that Enclave all wear cool ass power armor that looks dope and definitely not like Nazi fash Darth Vader costumes. They definitely don't look like that, and it's definitely not weird that BJ fawns over them. They land down on some raider house that looks suspiciously unmarked to BJ, because normally raider installations are like covered in corpses and stuff. Her and one of the other Clavers, specifically Sergeant Windwhisper, take out the raiders there. She saves Windwhisper's life, despite Windwhisper being like a tough-as-nails soldier horse who doesn't tolerate the civilian mixing with their military operation. And BJ is like, oh, cool, they have a bunch of fresh food. And like Sergeant Windwhisper like knocks it out of her hand. And he's like, oh, this is Enclave owned property. You're not allowed to touch it. And BJ's just kind of like, that's fucking weird. All right, whatever. We then zip to back to the operations area where BJ is hanging out with Glory in the cafeteria, discussing about how weird the Enclave is being, basically. Like, BJ has a weird feeling about them, and Glory, being the good Neolib that she is like, ah, it's fine. They're just, you know, military. It's fine. Minty Fresh is also there, the unicorn pony, and he mocks BJ by showing off that they have a magic spell that allows them to recreate any voice that they can hear by mocking their own voice. Glory goes off to get debriefed, and BJ bumps back into the sergeant again, who tells her to leave due to basically like Enclave racism. Like, it's, she's pretty naked about the idea that, like, oh yeah, the Enclave like shouldn't be here. Like, this place is a horrible wasteland of death. I don't understand how you assholes live here. It pushes a lot of that lovely fash language where they separate themselves from a foreign aggressor that has to be destroyed, otherwise they can't survive their like perfect paradise existence. Like, boy, they basically have a giant wall of clouds between them and everywhere else in the world.
I mean, like, it's yeah, no, come to think of it, it's very much like colonial mindset of like, man, this whole territory is useless and you guys are all dumb and useless, and that's why we're here, to like extract everything that we can from it. That's why we're down here harvesting like every piece of resource we can get our fucking paws on.
Yeah. My note here is basically like, BJ calls her out on it, like, yay, even rape horse can smell a fash. Like, I don't know, it's basically one fash to another, like, wow, my fascism isn't nearly as efficient as yours. That's kind of fucked up. BJ wanders to the area again. We get more, like, we get documents and shit of, like, in offices, about how the Marauders were intentionally split up, because despite being the baddest and the coolest and the strongest badasses that ever lived, they were also really surly to their lieutenant officers, and they would mysteriously die a lot. So they consider them too rogue to be valuable. So they were split up. I'm only really bringing this up because one character being split up from this and ending up in Zebertown, which is a ghetto. Don't get it twisted.
Great.
That's important to somebody else's backstory.
Great.
It's really critical. Sorry?
Great! That's great.
Yeah.
I'm super great.
That Zebertown is a thing that exists. That there was a zebra ghetto.
It's everything you would ever expect.
I'm surprised there aren't zebra concentration camps in the story, to be honest. But anyways, from notes that she got from Trottenheimer's computer way back in several chapters ago, we found out that, like, he was keeping something hidden here, in a hidden compartment and in his office, or in his like desk here. So we find a little black box which contains a very large caliber silver bullet, and it's titled as a silver bullet when she puts it in her pack, and it reads on her pip book. This is the thing that goes inside the gun that Trottenheimer made. God. We get snippets of a weird confession it sounds like coming from Glory talking about Rambo Dash when it's revealed that it's Minty Fresh in disguise, like he's disguising his voice and recording a fake confession from Glory. And then BJ gets shot by him using a trank gun. No, it's not a trank gun. It's an actual gun. She has bullets in her. She just gets knocked unconscious because that's what happens when you get shot in this story.
Well, no, I mean, she's gotten so immunized to bullets. She's built up a hardy resistance.
She's been shot with lower caliber bullets to build up a resistance to higher caliber bullets. She wakes up to Glory losing it on light hooves in the operating area. And threatens to go over his head and directly to her father. And Light, who's just kind of like, oh, whatever you say. Like, he doesn't want to cause waves. Glory and BJ then have a private conversation where Glory reveals a plot point that BJ would not care about. Like, this is... Fuck it, this is going to be a long episode anyways. But this is a point that I keep coming back to in the story. BJ is supposed to be, like, part of a matriarchal society. So her default is women run everything. Hypothetically, from this society. But she never comments even once when it's weird that a male is running a dominant part of society. Like, the fact that Glory's father is a member of, like, essentially an elected set of officials. He's basically, like, the pony prime minister of a particular region of the enclave. That doesn't strike her as weird because, like, it's not weird to the author, and he doesn't.
Yeah, it's almost as if, like, the like pony matriarchy is meant to serve a specific purpose.
Yes.
And making a, like, meaningful meditation on how that shapes a person is not it.
Yes.
Whoops. Okay. Well.
Whoops. It's a frustrating detail I keep coming back to. Is like, why isn't it weird to her that she's having a conversation with a man and not fucking him? Like you establish that she apparently is a rape monster, like the rest of them. Like, how is it that she's like having a conversation with priests and not thinking, man, I really no, I'm wrong. She does think about wanting to fuck him, but she doesn't force herself on him like she would in the stable, which is what's weird about it. Christ, I hate that I'm talking about this. But anyways. Glory's father is this cool badass. He's basically Solid Snake. Actually, no, he's Big Boss. He has an eye patch. Fuck it. He's some badass like military official turned civilian who fought a dragon once, and he's the coolest forever. BJ keeps insisting that something's wrong with the operation, but Glory just won't have it because she's basically like, well, they're enclave and I'm enclave. If you don't trust them, then you have to trust me. BJ mentioned
the framing. Like, they're framing you right now. They're in the process.
Well, she doesn't. She's dumb, so she doesn't get it right away. Yeah. See, this is my problem. Like, this is the problem. Like, BJ is practically minded, is if you interpret it the way I do, but she's dumb because Somber needs her to be dumb whenever it's convenient.
Oh, this is the worst. This is like that's the most irritating conceivable trope. I need to convince you that these guys aren't up on the up and up. Oh, like. Can you give me an example of how they're not on the up and up? I can't think of anything. Glossing over, like, incredibly blatant, incriminating, like, how is anyone that dumb? How could anyone, like...
You're literally only this dumb if you're fictional. That's the only way.
Oh, okay. Right. Oh, good. Oh, I wasn't ready. There was a...
I keep sucker punching you with these.
Oh, I'm Harry Houdini with his appendix exploding. Like, okay. Yeah, no, push on. I'm ready. I'm good.
We gotta keep going.
I'm on my feet.
Yeah, we're almost there. BJ beats one of the guards with a fire extinguisher and knocks them out. And steals their uniform, which is really crazy that just happened.
Stormtrooper uniform. It maximizes impact from the outside.
But she sneaks away to where the power armor is kept in the armory. She gets weird, warm, tingly feelings over them. Well, I say warm, tingly feelings, but the way she describes it is, I get warm, tingly feelings over thinking about shotguns. This made me almost orgasm on spot, which, I mean... Fuck it, we're here now, I guess.
Okay, yeah, no.
This is actually foreshadowing, too. She beans a couple more guards. She gets into a prisoner area where she finds out that there was a Dashite, which again were the people that are ashamed of the that are ashamed from the Enclave, that has been experimented on. But when she tries to save her, she gets her head blown off by Minty Fresh, who turns out he can turn invisible.
Sure.
BJ defeats his invisibility, kind of fun though. She just there's a bunch of papers and shit in the area, so she just and they're in a dusty building, so she just she just telekinetically just throws shit around, and the silhouette of him gets cast in the invisibility. And then she shoots him. This doesn't kill him though, because then BJ then tortures Minty via Raider, which is a fucked up thing about, because one of the other cages had a Raider in it, so he's just being held up to the bars while the Raider is biting chunks out of him.
It's our hero, ladies and germs. Hero.
Yep. She's a tough as nails cop who isn't above using torture to get the job done. we learned that the Raider disease doesn't affect Pegasi, so the Pegasi, the Enclave, want to weaponize it against the ground to exterminate all of the horses down there. I talked really long time ago about the fact that Glory dropped from working as making biochem weapons as a project. Like, that was the project she was on, and she wanted to be transferred to the Volunteer Corps. This is what I think it was. So yeah, that's cool.
If it was, then I'm done with Dr. Professor Scientist, because she is now she's upgraded to the dumbest character. I don't know what sort of cognitive dissonance is required to think that Peace Corps mission is going to be a viable thing when the government is already when you are part of the government Extinction Project.
Yeah. Well, she didn't know that is the excuse given. She only knew that it was we're doing something shady with chemicals, and I don't feel right about that. And it's that cliche in stories that only this scientist could ever solve the cure or whatever. So if they're taken out of the equation, then the government will never be able to figure it out. Which is a cliche that makes no goddamn sense when you know anything about science.
But it makes plenty of sense when you believe in the Randian Ubermensch. That history, the great man theory of history.
Yes.
Only one person in 100 generations could accomplish this thing.
But yeah, so Dr. Glory is the only one who could ever have created the bioweapon project, is essentially the narrative that gets kind of dropped entirely after a point, because it's not really ever mentioned again what she was working on before the Volunteer Corps.
Cool. The further we go along, the closer we get to space missions. That's the light I see in the distance. That's
the closer we get to what? Sorry.
Space ninjas. I've been promised space ninjas.
Okay. Yeah. The closer we get there, the closer we get to space ninjas fighting nonsense and Shodan is just there.
Anyway, so torturing a dude by having a zombizzle eat him pieces.
Yeah, a zomboni. Eat him to death.
Zomboni, I'm sold.
Yeah, a zomboni. My little zomboni. That probably exists. If I Google that, there's probably my little zoni.
It sounds like a pun on Zamboni, so yes. I am acquiring this disease now in my head, cause you to spontaneously manifest hockey equipment.
And move very slowly. Anyways, before he can say too much, Lighthooves caps Minty off, and again, Lighthooves is incredibly unflappable, but again, I actually like his characterization here. He's you killed my best operative, you want a job, clearly the only one that can get any shit done around here.
I mean, that's a very Mongolian, outlook. It's a very big problem. It's admirable.
Yeah, I like Lighthooves. He's a good villain. I'm doing my job, and part of my job is, acquisitioning resources that will be useful to the Enclave, so, you kind of fit that bill. I know you just killed, four people, but, that only just proves my point. But, anyways, he then just instead plans to capture and sell her off to, after killing her to Deos. He rambles a little bit about Sky Striker, Glory's dad, and he's made the Enclave soft, and they have to go back to the old way. BJ is carted off to by a pair of executioners to be killed in one of the interrogation rooms. While that's happening, because there's really no real good way to exposition this, there is a audio recording that's played through all of the speaker systems in the area that say that Glory gives a confession that she is she's a Dashite and always has been, and she wants to kill the Enclave or something. It's all a fake confession, obviously. The two guards kind of menace her for a bit, and then she just fucking murders one of them with her telekinetic bullets. And it basically goes, "Hey, I'm gonna do the same to you if you don't let me out." So, you know, she gets let out, and she steals a bunch of their drugs and gear off of them because she's going to need it for the coming events of the story. Okay, cool. We'll get into this part. She ends up in the interrogation room next to where Gloria is, like the observation room opposite to the interrogation room, so she can see her through the one-way black glass. Where we find out that Glory is getting her cutie mark chemically burned off and then branded with the Dashite symbol to make the whole turncoat stick, I guess. Basically, like she's been. We talked about this in a previous episode about how like this sucks because it's not because she learned to realize that the Glaive is like bad. It's being forced on her, the consequences of a fake turn. Like, this is what would happen if she turned, and even then she's still fairly loyal to the Glaive after this, and it takes a really, really long time for her to get out of this mindset that they're even remotely good. And even then, the Enclave is still fairly, like, it's like, yeah, sure, they're fascist, but that's only really the military. Like, there's still civilians up there in the sky, and it's like, yeah, but, like, so? Like, the military is trying to kill everyone, and they think, like, they need a perpetual enemy, and that's the surface for them. But anyways, Blackjack has a rage Hulkout moment. She takes a bunch of drugs to power herself up because, you know, combat drugs in Fallout kind of nonsense. We get a blackout scene because Sombra doesn't know how to transition anything. We wake back up in a puddle of gore. Blackjack is literally covered head to toe in gore from the two guards that were chemically burning Glory. It turns out she had taken the table that was in the operation room and threw it through the black glass window between the two of them. BJ and Glory have a little heart to heart, which is kind of jarring. It's like, again, one of those moments of like, oh yeah, early Flash Newgrounds to steal something from Weird. Of like, hey, this is a pastel horse, like coping with the stress of being chemically burned and branded a traitor to her own family, and the other horse is covered head to toe in blood. But they have a heart to heart, and it gets Glory kind of out of her fugue state. All right, we're getting real close to the end now. They get outside where they're immediately accosted by a Vertipug blowing up part of the area around them and starting to fire at them with machine guns. BJ retaliates and kind of gets like clipped for it a couple of times. She then has a light bulb moment where she's like, oh, I just got a bullet for the gun that I've been twirling around for a while that probably is pretty dangerous. So she loads the bullet into the gun, which admittedly is kind of a cool setup to this bullet to sell how strong this gun is. Is it like links to her pip buck and all this like information comes down in on a screen of like confirmation of all this status and like, do you want to accept? And like, it like magically bolts her to the ground to use it because of the force of the bullet firing. And she aims it at the Vertibuck, and the Vertibuck is just erased. Like, it's not even shot through. Like, the Vertibuck is just gone. And then the cloud cover and the direction in which it was fired gets a hole in it because the bullet is that strong. And it's like, luckily, Lighthooves manages to escape, even though the Vertibuck gets vaporized. And we kind of get a cool scene that probably should have been the end of this chapter, given like the tone, where like BJ is about to pass out because of the drugs finally starting to wear off, and she's like laying on the ground and like telekinetically pointing the gun at Lighthooves in the air, and she just kind of like makes like the bang, like kind of like motion with it, and then passes out, which would have been a cool chapter ender. But instead, we end the chapter actually them having another conversation with Windwinder, whatever her fucking name is, where it reveals that despite hating the ground ponies, she thinks that the Enclave has been knowingly poisoning the surface ponies with food they've been giving out to them. And she's going to take this information to her superiors and see what they can do about it. But otherwise, like, she can't help them much. And that's kind of just how we end the story. Like, end the story. Yeah, the story's over. I've been tricking you this
whole
time.
Oh, man. What a goddamn relief. Like, I was looking forward to those space ninjas, but...
Psych. It's actually what goes on for much longer than this. Oh, man. Yeah, this chapter... At least the chapter ends kind of in a, like a... In my opinion, a kind of cool way of getting a big fuck you gun with a big fuck off bullet and just kind of like vaporizing a
wait, is the bullet retrievable? Is the bullet actually just a power source? Is this the only fire?
No, it's a single charge. It's a single fire. So she can only fire it once for every bullet she has.
But why would there be a bunch scattered around? No,
for mysterious purposes.
What?
Okay.
Okay, we're done.
Yeah, we can't finish. Yeah, we can't finish without plugging our stuff. We gotta plug our iTunes. Remember to write, rate, review, subscribe. Tell us, tell friends. Word of mouth is the important part of this whole process. We could not do well. We could do this without you, but like it would be less fun if people weren't listening.
Yeah, tell us what you think.
These chapters are pretty heady, wanna play us out now, Weird.
He's fine. I'm Weirdington, Esquire, and this has all been a terrible mistake.